This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
The Republican convention last week was very much the Donald Trump show, co-starring the shouted stylings of Kimberly Guilfoyle. Trump talked law and order and the Democrats' post office scam, that's how he put it, and how things were pretty much perfect before, quote, the plague came in from China. 4 years after accepting his first nomination, the president's relationship to the Republican Party still confuses many people, both inside and outside the party. Is Trump an aberration within the GOP? Is he different from the party's culture and policy assumptions? Or does his presidency represent a continuity from the Reagan era onward? To answer that very complicated question, our staff writer Andrew Morantz sat down with historian and journalist Rick Perlstein. Perlstein has just published a new book called Reaganland. It's the capstone of his four-volume history of the American right. Here's Andrew Morantz.
So Rick Perlstein is this journalist and historian who he's been writing these really kind of monumentally big and immersive histories of essentially the 20th century American conservative movement. So just to set it up, you know, for those who don't know, for the last 23 years, you've been working on this four-book cycle, some 3,000 pages, right? How many pages?
Sounds about right, give or take. You know, it's like Everett Dirksen, you know, the late Illinois senator used to say a billion here, a billion there, and soon you're starting to talk about real money. You know, yeah, I mean, let's say 3,000 pages, sure.
Yeah. I've always been interested in his books because, you know, there's a lot of presidential biographies out there. There's a lot of, you know, books about American politics out there. But his books are kind of unique in how much they're about the mood of the country, the popular culture, what it was like day by day, week by week to live through something like Watergate or to live through something like the late 70s where, you know, New York City is having a blackout and nobody knows, you know, where to go and everything is kind of chaotic. And that kind of feeling and that mood, you can kind of get from Perlstein's books in a way you can't really get anywhere else. Where Rick Perlstein starts his four-book cycle is with the 1964 race. And this was in an era when the two parties were not ideologically sorted the way they are now. There were liberal Republicans, there were conservative Republicans, there were liberal Democrats, there were conservative Democrats. It was a coalition of regional interests, but it wasn't, you know, ideological blocks. And it was actually seen as self-defeating to be too ideological.
So the narrative was that the American right was this kind of wild west of open racists, anti-Semites, you know, conspiracy theorists, was, you know, had no kind of purchase in American politics. But the idea is that, you know, William F. Buckley comes along.
We will explore the question of the future of the GOP and of the conservative movement. I take pleasure in introducing a great man and a good friend.
He's this, you know, bright young Yaley, speaks fluent Latin, you know, and he starts a magazine, National Review, you know, the marquee conservative magazine that started in 1955, in which he's going to turn conservatism into basically an intellectually respectable movement.
The only successful mutiny against the political scriptwriters in recent times. It having been ordained that no forthright conservative could be elected to any important executive office.
And through that act, that's what allows someone like Barry Goldwater to come to the fore as a nominee for the Republican Party without that taint of open racism, anti-Semitism, and all the rest.
So Barry Goldwater was this very staunch conservative senator from Arizona, and he stood for this ideologically principled conservatism, which was often called extreme. And actually, Goldwater famously embraced that label.
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
And when he got the Republican nomination, it was this surprising, shocking thing, kind of not entirely unlike when Donald Trump won the Republican nomination. But then what was supposed to happen next with Trump did happen with Goldwater, right? He lost in a landslide. So this thing that we were predicting would happen in 2016, that did happen in 1964. So then all these sort of nice, clean-cut liberal historians got to say what they wanted to say all along, which was Goldwater was always too fringe for the American electorate. He was never electable in the first place. This just shows that if you're too extreme and you're too ideological, you're never going to get anywhere in American politics, right? And so that became the entrenched narrative.
I really accepted sort of a standard narrative of the history of conservatism, propounded by conservatives themselves, that central to their political success, basically how they entered prime time, was through the act of disciplining the fringes of their coalition.
So Perlstein's second book is called Nixonland, comes out in 2008. And that's about the rise of Nixon, how he triumphs in these two big elections. Then in Perlstein's third book called The Invisible Bridge, we start getting Nixon's downfall. And by the middle of that book, Nixon is disgraced. He's left the White House. It just seems like no one of his ilk is going to be able to rise again. Nixon was this kind of shocking, alienating, angry figure. And so how can that right wing of the Republican Party ever be successful again? So you're kind of, you know, spit out into this landscape of, okay, Nixon's gone. The country needs a unifier. And everyone at the time is kind of assuming that that unifier is going to come from somewhere from the center of the political spectrum. And what Reaganland shows is that Ronald Reagan was able to become that unifier, not from the center, but by actually picking up on the really ideological, extreme conservative commitments of Richard Nixon and just kind of putting a more optimistic, shiny gloss on them.
I believe the Republican Party has a platform that is a banner of bold, unmistakable colors with no pale pastel shades.
One of the things that made Reagan's election so paradigm-shifting was that he managed to attract an enormous amount of former Democratic voters into the Republican coalition. But by the same token, in this long campaign in 1980, he received some rather remarkable endorsements, and perhaps the most remarkable was Martin Luther King's right-hand man, best friend, Ralph Abernathy, in whose arms Martin Luther King had died, who gave a very warm and enthusiastic endorsement of Ronald Reagan. Now, in a lot of ways, that shows the extraordinary charm and political gifts of Ronald Reagan, but it also shows an absolutely bedrock part of the Reagan strategy, which was that they knew that if they appeared, if what we now call, sort of white swing voters in the suburbs, associated Ronald Reagan with bigotry and racism, that they wouldn't vote for him.
But then as Perlstein is putting the final touches on this magnum opus, he's writing the fourth installment of how modern conservatism came to be what it is. As he's doing that in 2015 and 2016, he's watching Trump spit on John McCain's legacy as a war hero.
I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you. Do you agree with that? He's a war hero.
And, talk about how all the Republican trade policies of the last 20 years should be thrown out the window and, saying the quiet part loud. And
they're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
All this carefully calibrated dog whistle strategy that all these Perlstein books show how carefully plotted the dog whistle politics of racism has been in the Republican Party, and how hard they've tried to build a Southern coalition based on, you know, appealing to racist tendencies but not saying that stuff out loud. As he's sitting down to write this book, Trump is winning a Republican primary by saying that stuff out loud.
This is a country where we speak English, not Spanish.
Can you think of a time when you were writing Reaganland and then, you know, you finished a day's writing and sort of like flipped on the TV and saw Trump talking about deporting 12 million people or saw him talking about, you know, executing the Central Park Five or something and went, I might need to revise what I wrote today? Or, you know what I mean? Did you ever have those moments?
You know, it's still happening, right? Right now we're talking as, you know, the QAnon cult, you know, that Democrats are, you know, involved in a conspiracy to kill children, right, is entering the mainstream as never before. And, you know, I woke up this week, you know, this week in which I'm promoting the book and, you know, thought, well, you know, a huge part of the anti-gay agenda that drove the Christian right during the period I'm writing, that really kind of replaced segregationism as the kind of guiding rage among fundamentalist Christians, was the conspiracy theory that gays were recruiting children. And in the case of a very prominent minister named James Robeson, who's still around and still prominent, in the spring of 1979, he gave a broadcast in which he said that gays in widespread organized fashion were not only recruiting young boys, but murdering them. His affiliate, the place where he recorded his show, it took him off the air because this was kind of like a last straw. He, you know, attacked other religions so much. And in this particular case, the local gay group demanded equal time. And this was a galvanizing event. He became a martyr. It became one of the galvanizing events for the politicization of the Christian right going into the 1980 election. And him and his young publicist, the fellow named Mike Huckabee, staged a rally in which 10,000 Christians hooted and hollered and basically were advocating for him to have the right to go around saying that gays were out to murder children. And Mike Huckabee was actually interviewed in The New Yorker. And he was quoted saying that there was so much feral rage in that building that if James Robeson had told people to walk down to the TV station and take it apart brick by brick, they would have done it.
I'm sick and tired of hearing about all of the radicals and the perverts and the liberals and the leftists and the communists coming out of the closets. It's time for God's people to come out of the closets, out of the churches, and change America.
Right, so that kind of energy is certainly not new with Trump. It probably has not had that much explicit representation in a place like, say, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, for whom, certainly in the case of Ronald Reagan, disciplining what got said behind closed doors and in public was an enormous part of the political work of that administration.
Rick Perlstein is a guy who writes from a left vantage point. He writes for leftist publications. He writes these books that are about the modern conservative movement, but yet he's not writing these books as polemics about why conservatism is bad. He's writing a version of conservatism that actually some conservatives recognize themselves in. Like, he's more interested in giving a really rich chronicle of almost the psychological needs of the American populace. Like, what was it in the American psyche or almost in the American soul that made them yearn for someone like Ronald Reagan? This seems to be one of the underlying narrative questions of this book. Why was someone like Jimmy Carter not enough? Why did America fall out of love with him?
It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will.
And I think where other people might look to some specific political outcome, or they might look to the hostage crisis, or they might point to this or that speech, I think Perlstein's move is much more often to set a mood and talk about why the mood of the country was out of step with the mood that was being conveyed by a particular campaign or by a particular White House. 1977 was the era of Star Wars and Rocky, and that was what people were clamoring for. They wanted these very clear-cut stories about good versus evil. They wanted the heroes to triumph in the end, and Star Wars was not a Jimmy Carter type of film. Star Wars was a Ronald Reagan type of film. You know, so that's really more the kind of analysis you get in these books. Obviously, you get a lot of politics and you get a lot of, you know, who did or didn't vote for this or that bill. But in the words of another conservative figure of this century, Andrew Breitbart, he had this phrase, politics is downstream of culture. And I think that's the sense you get from reading these books, that culture and politics are certainly all mixed up together, and there's this kind of intangible mood of any given moment that I think Perlstein would probably say is only fully knowable in retrospect, that he's trying to unearth, that I think sometimes can explain as much or more than, you know, a political science analysis can.
There is this, you know, constant appeal for, you know, reactionary ways of seeing the world, that the world is a scary place, America is a scary place, and people want to revert to, you know, easy truths and binary black and white ways of seeing the world. And that's just a constant in American history.
Rick Perlstein is the author of 4 volumes on the conservative movement. Reaganland was published this month, and he spoke with Andrew Marantz, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.